for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Anti-Muslim fervor is in the spotlight this week, much to the horror of many, including the president, a minister of a very small church in Florida, plans to burn the Quran on the anniversary of 9/11. The stunt symbolizes what many fear is a growing religious intolerance in this country. Joining me to talk about the history of religious and racial intolerance in the U.S., what's changed and what has not since 9/11, Barry Lynn. He's executive director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Robert Destro is director of the Interdisciplinary Program in Law and Religion at the Catholic University of America. And Aziza Al-Hibri is professor of law at the University of Richmond. We are going to take your calls. You're always an important part of the program. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to all of you.
Morning.
Morning. Morning.
Barry Lynn, if I could start with you, a group of prominent Christian, Jewish, and Muslim leaders recently described the situation today as an anti-Muslim frenzy. What do you see going on?
Well, it is a frenzy, but it's certainly one that has been mirrored many times in the past in the United States. You know, we Americans like to think we were always pretty tolerant people. We got along with everyone. But every time that religious minorities begin to be seen, exist, start to organize themselves, majorities tend to say, this is a danger to the republic. This is a danger to our country. This happened with Catholics. It happened with Mormons. It happens today with Muslims and, for that matter, other small minority religious groups in the country. So, sadly, it's nothing new, but it's always ugly, and it's very ugly these days.
What can you tell us about the minister in Florida and what is he trying to say?
Well, I think what he's done, he's a little church that has only 40 or 50 members, is called the Dove World Outreach Center, and apparently he wasn't doing too well even outreaching to Gainesville, Florida. He only had 40 members. But now he's become an international celebrity in the best and worst sense of the word. That is, he has taken his protests, which had gone pretty much unnoticed for the past 5 years, and because of adding the element of burning the Quran, now this has become an international crisis with world leaders who don't understand, in many cases, the power that the president doesn't, or in this case, does not have to stop this man. Now that he appears to be almost a party to silence, when in fact the president, as well as the Secretary of State, as well as Sarah Palin, have been pretty unequivocal in their opposition to what this gentleman in Florida is doing.
Barry Lynn, he's executive director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State and author of the book Piety and Politics. Bob Destro, how do you compare what's happening today with other eras in our society?
Well, it's actually very comparable. I mean, I think that Barry pointed out very nicely that we go through periods of this. It's about every 50 years, really. If you go back to when the first colonists came, the first thing they started doing was being intolerant to Roger Williams and kicked him out of Massachusetts for failing to do the Sabbath. If you get into the 1840s, there were Bible riots in Philadelphia where they shot into the side of a church with a cannon. Because they accused the Catholics who didn't want to have prayer in schools of taking the Bible. So, I mean, it's and then when you have a war, it's even worse.
So what you're saying is it's a part of who we are and what we have been right from the very beginning, even though we like to call ourselves the most democratic, the most tolerant society in the world.
I think that's right, but we also get over it. It's part of the assimilation process. We get great Supreme Court cases like Pierce versus Society of Sisters when they tried to shut down the Catholic schools, or no German in teaching in grade schools. So, you know, we get over this, and I think we'll get over this one too. Here we are on the radio talking about it. That's great.
Well, I hope you're absolutely right. Robert Destro is professor of law, director of interdisciplinary program in law and religion at the Catholic University of America. And now turning to you, Aziz Al-Hibri, you say that discrimination against Muslims in this country is nothing new.
That is correct. And in fact, there is a lot of misperception about when did Muslims arrive in this country. A lot of people speak about us as recent immigrants who are the latest wave, you know, on the boat. In fact, Muslims have been in this country since before the 14th century. And many of the African-American slaves who were brought from Africa were Muslims. And there are books about how they were prevented from practicing their religion at the same time that the founding fathers were passing the First Amendment that guarantees the practice of religion. Jefferson and others had most likely Muslim slaves. And I concluded that just from seeing the writings of Jefferson about freedom of religion and the sort of customs that people of other religions engage in. Also, you know that Jefferson had a copy of the Quran, which is now at the Library of Congress. So the founding fathers were familiar with these things and familiar with the atmosphere at that time, and were very careful to navigate through it so that they don't get caught into it. For example, at that time, Humphrey Purdue wrote about Islam, and he has a book which he called The Nature of the Imposture, Fully Displayed in the Life of Muhammad. They called Islam a false religion. Many of these things that we're hearing today have happened as early as the 1800s. We had at that time, through Jefferson, an attempt by that president for a regime change in North Africa, very much like what we're going through today. I think we can overcome all these cycles if we just bring them to consciousness, out of subconsciousness, and have a true dialogue among all Americans about the Islamic religion. We would be happy to chat about it and allay the element of fear that lies in lack of knowledge.
Aziz Al-Hibri, she's professor of law at the University of Richmond. She's founder and chair of Karama, a Muslim women's lawyers, Muslim women lawyers for human rights. And you are invited to join us, 800-433-8850. Barry Lynn, what's changed is 9/11. And instead of focusing on a small group of radicals, we seem to have enveloped all Muslims into our thinking.
Yes, sadly, that is the case. And I think there's just been an overwhelming amount of misinformation about the nature of Islam, the nature of Islamic law, and also what the nature of the average Muslim believer is. So now we find such absurd comments being taken as commonplace knowledge that Sharia law, Muslim law, right out of the Middle Ages, people would say, that's the goal of Muslims in America. I was just told that a few days ago on a certain unnamed Fox TV network. And the truth is, people honestly believe that even though Muslims in America constituted most of 1% of the population, and most of those people have no interest whatsoever in turning the Constitution into a document of Sharia law, people fear it. They fear that it's coming. And this is part of the traditional difficulty in the country. As soon as a religious minority starts to become part of the dialogue, then to some Americans, sadly, they become a threat to the established order. They are the others, and they are to be feared and harmed if necessary.
At one point, Roman Catholics became the object of that fear. And it was right after John F. Kennedy was elected president, Barry.
It certainly was. And although Bob Destro is not a Pollyanna about it, I do think sometimes the trend is not always in one direction. So there were state constitutions in the colonial period in South Carolina, Massachusetts, that prohibited Catholics from holding office. We kind of got over that. But then in 1960, when John Kennedy appeared to be possibly the first Catholic president, Norman Vincent Peale, who was an extraordinarily powerful Protestant evangelist at
and
the time,
popular.
Very popular, terrific book writer, best-selling author, starts a group and makes a statement that said, faced with the election of a Catholic, our culture is at stake. Our culture is at stake. So, frankly, of course, we're on about the 50th anniversary today of John Kennedy going to Houston, Texas, and speaking to Baptists and explaining that he was a Catholic, but his loyalty as president was to the Constitution. And that was a speech many historians say may have won him that election in 1960.
He went on to say it is inconceivable that a Roman Catholic president would not be under extreme pressure by the hierarchy of his church to accede to its policies with respect to foreign interests, and that the election of a Catholic might even end free speech in America. Those, the thoughts, the words of Norman Vincent Peale in anticipation of the election of John F. Kennedy back in 1960. Short break. We'll be right back. And we're joined now by Andrew Kohut. He's president of the Pew Research Center. Good morning, Andy.
Good morning, Diane.
Tell us what your recent poll suggests about attitudes toward Muslims here in the U.S.
Well, I think the most important thing to know is there's no signs of backlash in response to Muslims these days. The national public has mixed views of Muslims as they've had over the past 8 years or so, a little less positive than they were right after 9/11, when President Bush did a pretty good job of making the case that this was not a Muslim attack on America. But ever since, we've seen a somewhat less positive response. For example, we get about equal numbers of people saying that Islam encourages violence more so than other religions, and almost as many people say that that's not the case. So there's really no sign that, particularly over the past year or so, or even in recent months, that the numbers are any different on Muslims.
So this Florida pastor, or so he calls himself, sort of telling everybody he's going to burn the Quran, is simply sort of hyping the whole anti-Muslim fervor, perhaps trying to build on something that's not even there.
Yeah, I think that just because you have an incendiary provocateur, pardon the expression, doesn't mean that the American public is going to fall into place.
Yeah.
There's a great deal of sympathy, actually, for Muslims. We found last year when we asked, is there a lot of discrimination against a variety of groups, 58% said there was a lot against Muslims compared to 35% for Jews, 26% for evangelical Christians. And Muslims themselves, we did a major survey back in 2007, said back then 53% said, you know, it's difficult to be a Muslim in America since 9/11. And I think a lot of Americans pick up on that, which isn't to say that there aren't a very significant, small but significant numbers of people who have rather negative attitudes. But they haven't changed that much. And most people, you know, have sort of don't have the same positive they have view of Christians, but there's nothing in our polling at least that says this is blowing up in some respect.
And there is something of a perception that Muslims are having a hard time here in the U.S.
Absolutely. I mean, the only group that we see getting higher ratings in terms of discrimination are gays and lesbians when we ask the American public who's discriminated against in America.
Andrew Kohut, president of the Pew Research Center, thanks for joining us.
Sure, Diane. Thank you.
And turning back to you, Aziza, this whole question of 9/11 and how it changed perceptions. You pointed out during the break that, of course, Muslims were killed during 9/11.
Yes, some of them were just employees and workers in the building, and others were first respondents or people who decided to go and help and got killed in the process. The extent of the harm that came to Muslims in that building at that time is not really known around here. But also I'd like to point out that this is not the first time terrorism had struck. It had struck in Muslim countries before it struck in the United States. Algeria was the first one to ring the bell of terrorism, you know, and warn the United States and everybody else about it because they experienced it in their own country. And we know that Saudi Arabia had suffered from it. If it is an Islamic phenomenon, so to speak, why are the Muslim countries subjected to it? Clearly, this is a very small group with a certain political idea, and using the religion as a garb to make it more acceptable to other people, just like, you know, some of the other actions we see by people of other religions. That's why it's very important to have an open conversation about it.
And to you, Bob Destro, give us some examples of the discrimination that Roman Catholics faced and the violence that occurred in the name of religion.
Well, I mean, once again, if you go back, say, to the 1920s, or the shortly after World War I, most of these things do take place around either big immigration waves or wars. And the Ku Klux Klan up in the Northwest decided that the Catholics were foreigners and that they were teaching foreign values, so they wanted to shut down the schools. In Nebraska, they passed a law that really targeted primarily the Lutherans, who were German, and they read the Bible in German, and so they shut down. They tried to shut down the schools. They tried to shut down the curricula. So, in Philadelphia, it was a fight over which part of the Bible do you read, you know. So these questions reoccur. And it wasn't just Kennedy.
Barry.
Yeah, I also think it's important that we recognize that one of the other groups that does not turn out terribly well in most polls are non-believers. If you don't believe anything positive about religion or you don't believe in God at all, as late as the 1950s, not only could you not find publishers who would publish a book about atheism, you couldn't even find printers who would print your privately produced book about atheism. So in that sense, again, these days we see some reaction to the growing secularist movement from people who say, well, we never heard from these people before. Maybe they pose a danger. It's yet one more minority in America that is the subject of intolerance and bigotry, to the point where in a New York Times reported poll a few years ago, people of all the groups that they didn't want their sons or daughters to marry, at the top of the list, not Muslims, not Jews, atheists.
Interesting. Aziza.
I want to focus a little bit more on tolerance as opposed to intolerance. I do not want us to be overtaken by a small group and what they're doing in Florida. I'd like to point out, for example, that in one mosque in the United States after 9/11, which received a threat and the neighbors heard about it, when the Muslims came to pray the next day, there was a big chain surrounding the mosque, and it was a chain of non-Muslims protecting it from the threat. This is really the real America, as far as I know it, the America I lived in. The American people are very good people, and they do not intend to discriminate against anyone. That's why I say if we discuss it and make it clear, then people will move away from it. I also want to point out that this is a very sad event to be broadcast to Muslim countries at this time, because this is the year, by the way, in which the Emir of Qatar financed the rebuilding of a damaged church in southern Lebanon. This is the year that the Egyptian government renovated an ancient synagogue in Cairo. And this is not something new on their part. This is part of a tradition, an Islamic tradition that goes back over 1,000 years. We in the United States should do no less.
What similarities or differences, Barry, would you say exist between racial discrimination, religious discrimination? How do they compare?
Well, I think sometimes, as Bob pointed out earlier, the Ku Klux Klan, that historically had been concerned about matters of race and they wanted to discriminate on the basis of race, did take on the issue of religion and decided that Catholics, too, should be joined with African Americans as the targets of animosity, laws, and even acts of violence. So sometimes it's hard to distinguish the two. I think with religion, for some people, it's easier, more important to discriminate against people of other religions because you're talking about ultimate matters. You know, if you're wrong about a matter of affirmative action, you're just wrong here. If you're wrong about your religion, you could be suffering eternal consequences, negative ones, if you're picking the wrong religion. So people get fired up about religion in some ways, in ways more dramatic than they do about race over the last 50
Bob
years.
Bob Destro.
Well, I'd like to go back to something that that I think this is all correct, but something that Aziza said is, and I think the audience needs to think about this, is that there's 1 billion Muslims out there. You know, they don't want just toleration. They want respect, just like every other person. And we need to think that this man in Florida, I hate to bring back the attention to him, but he's not acting like an American. Our commanders have asked him not to do this. He's not acting Christian. Christ said, love your neighbors. You know, and he's not doing this. And this is strategically, this is idiotic.
Idiotic is, on the one hand, always in the eye and ear and mind of the beholder, but this man is getting support from some places, even though you've got the Secretary of State and you've got the President of the United States now coming out and saying this is something that could harm a great many people. To what extent do you think, Aziza, have popular views of Islam been tainted then by the actions of the very few?
Quite a bit. And I think part of the issue is how are we going to respond to that? The problem has been that the Orientalists, before even September 11, have filled the libraries with books that really did not understand Islam. These are people that went into the East, and specifically the Middle East, and saw it as a conquered country and wrote as outsiders without trying to understand the soul of the people. They came back, many of them, with very unusual conclusions that are now being picked up in universities as well as by the average person.
Give me an example.
Well... If you look at some of the work in the 18th century that I was referring to, you will again find two examples I will give you that seem very contemporary. One is the wish to liberate the Muslim woman from her man, oppressive man. And the other one is the Muslims in this country, because I mentioned to you there were Muslims in this country, as untrustworthy and possibly spies. And there were books about that. It sounds like it is today and not yesterday. Now, the Orientalists helped in that. In the writings they projected about Northern Africa during the Barbary Wars. In fact, you know, some of it is worth looking at again to see the kind of racism that was mixed with the religion. Because remember, if we're talking about North Africa, we're talking about Muslims who are darker skinned than ours. So racism plays a big role in this.
Aziza Al-Hibri, she's professor of law at the University of Richmond. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And we're going to hear from our listeners now. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Let's go first to Norfolk, Virginia. Good morning, Lewis. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane and your panelists. I want to say that this preacher who is attempting to burn the books, there's one word that the press has not used to label him, and that word is terrorist. If Muslims had decided in their masjid that they were going to burn Bibles, the word terrorist would be all over every major newspaper in the United States. This gentleman, terrorism doesn't always have to take the form of physical violence against a person. This, by his actions alone, he's putting our troops in danger overseas. This terrorist act he's doing is comparable to how David Koresh in Waco, Texas, Jim Jones, and Guyana, South America. These actions are very, very incendiary, very, very dangerous.
Indeed. Barry Lynn.
Yeah, I mean, and frankly, it appears that Reverend Jones doesn't really care about these implications. He understands that powerful speech sometimes results in powerful damage, and at least at this moment, he seems not to care about that. In fact, it will simply give him more power, he thinks, in his causes in the future.
Now, here's a question of law in which I'm interested. Doris, who's here in Washington, says, would it be a hate crime to burn the Quran? I hope that if the pastor in Florida goes ahead with his plans, he is arrested immediately, tried, and sentenced to prison. We live in a country of freedom of speech. You can burn the American flag. You can burn anything you want.
Yeah, you can. And I don't think that this in the state of Florida would constitute a hate crime. It's not directed at an individual. It is directed at a book. And it's obviously hateful and terrible. The only legal argument that I've heard that possibly could be used is there are local ordinances against burning things like trash or leaves
in public, and if
that was uniformly applied, if they had arrested somebody or fined somebody last year for burning trash in their backyard, maybe they could say you can't have an open fire of 200 Qurans. It's a thin reed, but it's the only one I've heard that makes any constitutional sense.
Aziza.
No, I don't understand why this could not be analyzed very fully as a national security issue. I mean, Bob had mentioned, and the president and General Petraeus, about all the damage that's going to possibly come to our troops as a result of this action. So you might say, well, do we want to use the national security argument to trump the First Amendment? Well, our government has already done that. In fact, Muslims are not allowed, but basically through restrictions, are unable to tithe every year as the religion requires because we are concerned about the money going to terrorists. So we have put very strict laws that have frozen the Muslims from being able to donate money. That's a First Amendment issue as well. So if we're going to use national security on one side, we should be able to use it on the other.
Bob Destro, you've talked a lot about immigration, assimilation. What makes for a good assimilation, and what makes for a bad one?
Well, the good assimilation is conversations like this. I think the best interface dialogue happens when you're both digging a ditch together and you get to know each other as human beings. And the problem with what we're discussing today, really, is that it builds barriers between ourselves and the Muslim world. I mean, most Americans don't understand that the first Muslim country to give condolences on 9/11 was Iran. You know, so there are real wonderful people out there. We need to enlist them against these crazies, and of whatever religion they are. And anything that builds a barrier is a national security concern.
Robert Destro is professor of law at the Catholic University of America. We'll take a short break, then more of your comments, questions. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. By the estate of Joan Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio. And by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. This is NPR.
The true legacy of social reformer Jane Addams is often overlooked today, but a century ago, she was one of the nation's most radical progressives. A new biography of the first American woman to win the Nobel Peace Prize, The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And welcome back. As we talk about tolerance, intolerance, and anti-Muslim attitudes that are currently across the land, here's an email from John in Dallas, Texas, who says, and his email, by the way, represents a great many we've already received. He says, I'm not a Muslim, Christian, or a Jew, so I feel I can make a good judgment from the outside. I know Islam is not a violent religion, but surely your guests would agree the leaders of Islam in America have done a very poor job of public relations and don't seem to care what Americans think about Islam. Why don't the leaders of Islam in America do a better job of calming the fears of so many? Aziza.
It's partly fair, partly unfair criticism. The fair part is that we could always do more. The unfair part is that a lot of the leaders, whoever these leaders might be, have tried to speak out, but they have not been able to reach the public channels that others so readily reach. So they have been trying in a variety of ways to make their voices heard. Now I think with these kinds of events, we get a chance to be on your show and other shows. But during the usual everyday discussion, nobody is really interested in making this a big topic. I know that for the last 20 years, I've been speaking about Islamic law and the fact that Islamic law has given Muslim women a great deal of rights, that they're not oppressed by religion but by culture. And in fact, I have been invited continuously to speak about it in various places, not only at home but abroad. But this is a big country, and we need a lot of voices to speak out, and it's going to take a lot of time before our message is heard.
And here is another email from Jeff, who says, I live in a very conservative and deeply Christian state. Many of my Christian friends are adamant that the Quran encourages violence against non-Muslims. What parts of the Quran are they citing? Where does this come from? They seem to want to outlaw this religion. Robert Destro.
Well, I think probably the easiest response to that is to ask which person, which prophet is mentioned the most in the Bible or in the Quran. And the answer is Jesus. And his mother Mary has a whole surah of the Quran about her. And so Christians need to read the directions. They need to read the book. And I think that's the encouragement we need. That's why, as Aziza said, you need to invite the imam over to the church for a conversation.
You know, there's an irony too, Bob. I suspect that if you had Jay Leno go out as he often does and say to people, "I'm going to quote something, and I want you to tell me who said it. I have come not to bring peace, but the sword." Did Muhammad say that, or did Jesus say it? I'll bet 2/3 of Americans say, sounds like Muhammad. Of course, it's from the book of Matthew.
Well, let me just say that this is a very good point. Part of the problem, whether it is with the Bible or with the Quran, is that people who want to talk about religion, many of them tend to take one verse here and one verse there and then analyze, when in fact you really need to look at the worldview presented by the Bible or the Quran to understand what that verse is doing in that context. That is a more difficult job, and people don't do it.
Let's go to Charles, who's driving in Michigan. Charles, I do hope you're pulling over before you comment.
Am I?
Go right ahead, sir.
Okay. I'm a Muslim of 22 years. African-American, born here in the States. I've heard a lot of conversation about hijackers of 9/11, the proposed center in New York, and I haven't heard any mention of the fact that the Quran specifically forbids the killing of innocents. It says that if you kill one innocent person, it is as if you have killed all of mankind. And if you save the life of one, it is as if you have saved all of mankind. How then is it that because these men spoke Arabic, the ones that ran the planes into towers, because they spoke Arabic, the connection to Islam was made immediately?
Because
if they had said God is great in English, that connection would not have been made.
He is absolutely right about the verse of the Quran that he cites. Islam not only respects human life, but also human dignity. For example, God says in the Quran, we have given dignity to the children of Adam. It didn't say to the Muslims or to the man, but to the children of Adam in general. So our dignity comes from God and not from a state or a human being.
And yet Rick from Indiana says Muslim countries are murdering Christians. That's more important to report than burning a few Korans.
Well,
what's
you know,
he talking about?
I'm sure that he's talking about some terrorist incidents that have ended up killing Christians. But I remind people also that there have been seven women heads of state in predominantly Muslim countries, which goes a long way, as Aziza pointed out, to suggesting that the general new or true interpretation of Islam certainly doesn't penalize women. In fact, it may indeed elevate them to the heads of their own countries.
And to Mary, who's in Gainesville, Florida, good morning to you. Mary, are you there?
Yes.
Go right ahead, please.
First of all, I think that it's important for everybody to know that there are a lot of counter-protests to this going on in Gainesville. I think the whole community is extremely embarrassed by the actions of Terry Jones, and just as, you know, Americans are embarrassed that this is taking place. But I want to say that I think that this hate-mongering that's going on right now has, in large measure, been promoted by the press. And I don't believe that anybody as trifling as Terry Jones, the Reverend, I use that sort of loosely, Terry Jones, whose criminal biography is coming to light more and more every day, I don't think anyone that trifling should have received the attention that he's wanted and that he's gotten. And I don't think that would have happened if it hadn't been that it's been given to him by the press. And I think that the same sort of thing goes on all the time. I think one of the biggest evidences of anti-Islam sentiment in this country are all these hurling around of accusations that the President of the United States, Barack Obama, is a Muslim, as though that somehow or other is a really bad thing for him to be. And, you know, I believe that that people like Glenn Beck, who can't say President Obama or Barack Obama without emphasizing that his middle name is Hussein, are the people who are promoting this. And I think that the press's reporting of it is a really, really bad thing. I mean, I know we can't stifle the press, but I don't think we need to emphasize the actions of idiots either. And I think
Barry.
I think, Mary, this is a real dilemma for anybody. And I did have a conversation with a reporter for one of America's great newspapers yesterday raising this issue. And her response was interesting. She said, look, we had internal debates about covering the Quran burning, but then when General Petraeus made his comment, it became of necessity a national and international news story.
And
I think that that's a justification.
And then the Secretary of State and
Correct.
Then the President
Correct.
Of the United States, Aziza, you wanted to make a comment?
Yes, I'm looking at my notes, and I wanted to share with you a comment or two. There is a treaty that the Prophet Muhammad very early on executed with the Christians, and I'd like to read from it in response to the claim about killing Christians. It says, the Prophet says, I will protect that is the Christians' backs, and defend them from any danger myself, and also with my helpers, the people of my faith and my followers, as if they were my own people and congregation. And then he goes on to speak about protections for bishops, for churches, etc. This is the tone that the Prophet set from day one.
Here's another thought from Ethan in North Carolina, which may really sum up this whole event. He says, book burning, demagoguery, xenophobia, pandering. Doesn't it remind you of another historical time and place when the economy was bad? Doesn't it remind you of a mass insanity that took over a country called Germany in the 1930s? Bob Destro.
I think that's, personally, I think that's a little over the top. And the reason I say that is that I think it's people are upset. They feel alienated. People don't have jobs. They feel adrift. And when these things happen, there's always that sense of outside threat. But, you know, but we should, I think, try and bring people together around this and to say, look, how do we best reach out to the Muslim world and become their partners in this fight against terror, because as Aziza pointed out, there's terrorism in the Muslim world, and this is really, in many respects, a fight among Muslims.
Let's go to Indianapolis. Jason, you're on the air.
Hi, Diana. I love your show.
Thank you.
The point I'd like to make is I think that some of the smaller congregations in certain areas kind of foster an underlying racism, whether they come out and say you need to be racist or not. I think there's kind of, in certain churches, a racist undertone. And I also believe there might be some churches kind of push a anti-government tone. And the other point I like to make, as I grew up in a small town in a suburb of Indianapolis called Plainfield, and there's a Muslim center out there. And I can remember as a kid, just certain names that were called, you know, people would call Muslims in my school and stuff. I mean, names I would not want to repeat on the air, but at a very young age. So, I mean, a lot of that obviously is fostered growing up from parents and stuff like that. And I guess I'll just take your guest remarks off.
All right. There. Thanks for calling. Barry.
Yeah, I mean, sadly, not only does the Dove World Outreach Center, it may only have 40 members, but it also has a kind of a Facebook page suggesting that people send in Qurans to be burned and so on. It had over 8,000 members when I checked on it the other day. So they do reflect maybe small numbers of people, but in a lot of parts of the United States. And much as we need to talk about tolerance and the good things, we also have to recognize that there is this real virus of insensitivity, racism, intolerance that occurs outside of Gainesville, Florida.
Barry Lynn, he's executive director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Luke would like us to talk about the anti-Masonic movement in the early 19th century. I'm interested in history, he says, but I've never heard much about this. Barry?
Well, there's always been a sense that any secret society or society that's not completely transparent is also secretly trying to plot the overthrow of the government. It wasn't just in the early 1900s that anti-Masonic sentiment occurred. It still occurs. The Masons become lumped in with other groups, the Illuminati, by people who believe that these are secret organizations trying to take over the world. Because we don't understand Masons, most of whom have no interest in taking over anything except perhaps the leadership of their own group in a local town. Nevertheless, it's all part of the. If we can distinguish them, if we can say those people are different than we are, then we can find a reason to dislike them, fear them, and try to put them out of business.
Here we go to Fort Drum, New York. George, you're on the air.
Thank you, Diane, for having me. I'm a soldier in the Army now 10 years, and I've had several combat tours. You know, from my personal experience, you know, there's families over there being prosecuted by their own people or persecuted by their own people for, you know, not holding the hardcore ideals of a few, you know, within their own countries. And I'd also like to go on and, you know, I was welcomed openly by every family that, you know, I met. I was given food, water, you know, anything that they could do to try and help us when we were there. You know, we're looking at the Muslim population as a whole by less than, you know, 1% of a fanatic, you know, people with their own individual ideals of what the Quran says. You know, I myself was an immigrant to the United States when I was 9 and a half, coming from Eastern Europe and Romania, growing up Greek Orthodox. I came here wearing, you know, a bow tie, a button-up shirt, slacks, and penny loafers. I got the crap beat out of me because I was different. You know, and I had to learn at a young age, you know, you either have to adjust to the ideals of the people around you or be persecuted. And it's entirely wrong to have to look at your own morals just to think that you have to do that to be safe.
George, thank you so much for your service and for calling this morning. I think he makes some good points. Finally, from Muhammad in Alexandria, Virginia, who says the issue is money. While the damage done is obvious, the real beneficiary is the pastor who now no doubt is inundated with cash flowing from the many thousands of sympathizers that the media has unwittingly mobilized. Do you all agree with that?
I think that's true. Usually you can follow the money back to motive. But I also think there is a great deal of misunderstanding of Islam. And I agree with Aziza. I think the media could do a much better job of educating people.
And last word, Barry Land.
Yeah, I'm not sure that this Terry Jones is going to become a celebrity. He won't be as big as the Jersey Shore people, I'm sure. Some money will go to him from bigots around the world. That's no doubt about it. But I don't think he's going to be offered a big-time contract anytime soon.
More talk. More dialogue necessary. That's all there is to it. Barry Lynn of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, Robert Destro of the Catholic University of America, Aziza Al-Hibri, Professor of Law at the University of Richmond. Thank you all so much.
Thanks
for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.